Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain at the hidden world of monetary control, control that determines whether economies succeed and who benefits. Ellen Brown is a lawyer, scholar, and best-selling author of Web of Debt and is president of the Public Banking Institute. Later in the program, we'll take a look at new developments in the public banking movement. But now, here's Ellen.
Thanks, Walt. I'll talk about the article I posted this week, Infrastructure Sticker Shock. The fact that we actually pay more, as much or more, to finance infrastructure as the things cost to build. When we're paying more to the financiers than to the contractors, it's time to do our own banking. When we hear about these bond issues, they only tell us the principal amount that will be paid. They don't tell us what the ultimate tab will be with principal and interest. But the general rule with government bonds is that you'll wind up paying twice what the actual face amount of the bond was. It's rather like when you take out a mortgage. If it's a 30-year mortgage for 5%, you will pay the bank as much or more than the seller got in principal out of the deal. So bonds are the same way, like a 30-year bond at 5%, you'll be paying half to the financiers and half to the actual cost of building the thing. In California, for example, we have the Delta Water Tunnels, which are a pet project of Jerry Brown. They're very controversial because it's not clear that's the best way to get water into the Delta. But not counting that, they don't tell us about how much these things are going to cost us. The price that's been put on it, or that we've always heard about, was $25 billion. But in fact, it will be, with interest and fees and a few other costs, calculated at $51 to $67 billion. And the actual cost of building the thing is $18 billion. So with interest and fees and a few other things, it can be four or five times what the voters thought they were getting. And then we have the example of the Bay Bridge retrofit, which was done to repair the earthquake damage to the Bay Bridge. It was supposed to be $6 billion. With interest and fees, it came out to $12 billion. Then there's the bullet train from Los Angeles to San Francisco, also a pet Jerry Brown project, which was $10 billion for the initial bond issue approved by the voters in 2008. And the interest and fees just on that bond will be close to $20 billion when it's all paid off. And those are just ordinary bonds. Then we have something called capital appreciation bonds, where the taxpayers can actually pay 10 times or more what the initial outlay on the bond is. It's typically school districts that fall for these bonds because they can't get their local voters to approve more money, but they need something. They need to build something. So they take out these loans where they don't have to pay anything now, but in 30 or 40 years, they'll get hit with this giant balloon payment. It's rather like those interest-free loans that subprime borrowers took out in the housing bubble, and then where it looked like they were paying no interest at first, but meanwhile, the interest was compounding so that you're actually paying interest on interest. Then you get hit with this giant balloon payment. So what we're doing with these capital appreciation bonds is imposing a giant debt on our children and our children's children because we don't have a way to fund things today. But of course, there is a way to do it. And the Chinese, among other people, have figured out how to do it. The Chinese have managed to build 4,000 miles of high-speed rail in the last 5 years. How did they get the funding? Their funding secret is that they own their own banks. If you own the bank, you don't have to pay interest, or you can pay the interest, but you get the interest back because you are the owner. And that is what we should be doing too. It would be different if we were actually borrowing some physical commodity that's in short supply, like gold, if we had to get the gold from someone else. But we now know that what we're borrowing is just bank credit. In fact, the Bank of England admitted that in March of this year. They came out and said in their quarterly bulletin, contrary to popular beliefs, banks do not lend their depositors money. they lend bank credit created on their books when the loan is made. So we, the people, could be doing that very thing ourselves and saving this huge cost in interest and fees. All you need to lend bank credit is to A, be a bank, which means getting a bank charter, and B, having capital and deposits. And all states have huge potential capital and deposit bases. They have a lot of money that they can't necessarily spend, but they can invest it or they can deposit it. In fact, we do deposit it, of course, in Wall Street banks. And Wall Street then does what we could be doing ourselves, which is leveraging our capital and deposits into credit for many purposes. They use it for their own purposes. They're not lending it back to us at the very good rates at which they're getting it. In California, Clint Richardson estimated that we have $600 billion in rainy day funds tucked all around the state. This is money that you can find in the comprehensive annual reports, or CAFRs, that all local governments are required to keep. This money can't be spent. It's earmarked for specific purposes, but it can be invested or deposited. So California could take that money or a portion of it and make it capital and deposits in its own bank and use that to create the $700 billion that we'll need in the next decade to fund infrastructure and that we don't otherwise have the money for. The only other alternative is to farm it out to private investors, but then that means privatizing what should be public assets. It means we'll be paying fees in perpetuity to use things that should have belonged to we the people outright. The guest I'll be interviewing today is a longtime expert in how our banking system really works. He has some interesting ideas about how we can fix our dysfunctional system.
It's my pleasure to be speaking today with Thomas Greco. Tom is a writer and lecturer who is regarded as one of the leading experts in monetary theory, monetary history, credit clearing systems, and complementary currencies. He's the author of numerous books and articles. His most recent book is The End of Money and the Future of Civilization, an intriguing title. He is also a former college professor who has traveled all over the world lecturing, teaching, and advising. Greetings, Tom. It's great to be speaking with you.
Hello, Ellen. Thank you.
You've written extensively on the dysfunctional nature of our conventional money and banking system and how a more ideal money system could be structured. You're really good at outlining the problem, so I thought I'd start with that for our listeners who might not have it's a difficult subject. Where would you say that our money system has gone wrong, and why is there never enough money to go around?
Well, you have to understand that money has evolved over time. Initially we started with basic gift economy, where people in small communities basically gave each other what they needed. But on more impersonal relationships, then you had the trading fairs where people would come together and basically barter one thing for another. And then you had different commodities that were used as exchange media. We're talking about how to mediate the exchange process. The problem is that most of us produce very little of what we need, so we rely on others to produce it, and we get what we need by trading with them. So there are many ways to mediate this trade process. What we have to understand is that money is really an instrument for mediating reciprocal trade, where you expect to get as much value as you give and give as much value as you get. So that's where we have to start. We have to look at reciprocal exchange and how that can be mediated. Now, as I was saying, the evolution of this process continued on from commodity money, and different things were used as commodity money in history. In the American colonies, we used tobacco, we used animal hides, bullets, nails, salt, sugar, various things that were in general demand could be used as exchange media. Historically, gold and silver and other precious metals became favored as exchange media because they were lightweight, durable, scarce, could be divided into smaller units. And so we had a period of commodity money and a banking system that was built on commodity money. But eventually, bankers realized that they could lend out banknotes that were not backed by gold or silver, but were simply an obligation of the bank, basically credit. And this invention of credit money was a very important step in the evolution of the exchange process. And the problem is that credit has been monopolized by the banking cartel, and it is allocated, it's kept scarce, it's allocated on a partial basis to entities like central governments, corporations, and favored clients of the banks, and it is kept scarce for everybody else. And one of the problems we're experiencing right now in the economic crisis that we've been in since 2008 is that the small and medium-sized enterprises, which comprise the backbone of any local economy, have been starved for credit, while most of the credit has been given to the national government and mega corporations. So we have this process of credit monopolization. And so credit is kept scarce, which enables the banks to charge interest for it. But basically, it's our credit. You know, every national currency is supported by the collective credit of the people who are required to accept it as payment. So it's my credit and your credit and everyone else's credit that supports the U.S. dollar. The fact that the government can impose taxes and the fact that the government, in collusion with the central bank, can monetize its own debts really is a major problem, because we have two basic parasitic elements built into the money system. You've got the interest that banks charge for the use of our own credit, and you've got the inflation that results when the banks monetize the government debt, which basically is a legalized form of counterfeit money, which results in increasing prices in the marketplace. So that's the basic problem with the money system as it exists today. It's all based on compound interest, and compound interest is a exponential growth function. And if you look at the empirical evidence for the growth of debt throughout the world over the past many decades, you'll see that it is growing exponentially. And debt cannot continue to grow exponentially, just as anything else cannot continue to grow exponentially. At some point, it begins to shoot skyward at such a rapid rate that it just overwhelms anything in the real world. If you look at insect or animal populations, for example, we can take a lesson from nature. We see that when animal populations explode and outrun their food supply or the carrying capacity of their environment, you have a catastrophic die-off. So if we're going to avoid a catastrophic collapse of the global financial and money systems, we're going to have to find some way to taper off this exponential growth in debt. And that means ending the interest-based, debt-based money system.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that credit is actually a good thing. It has allowed economies to expand. It was
well, that's
credit.
What I said.
Yeah,
that's
but the problem is that when banks create credit, they always want more back than they put out there, and in fact, they want twice as much back as they put out there over a 30-year loan at 5%. You're going to pay the bank as much again as so you're going to pay the bank double, but where is
That's
that
right.
extra money to come from, since all of our money, except whatever, 3% of it, the coins and paper money, and you can argue about the paper money, it's all created by banks as loans. So you could still have a credit system, and I know that's your solution, a mutual credit clearing system. I would argue that interest itself is not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, it's a way to... I should get to yours. So you're heavily into community currencies, which of course I think are a great thing and a great way to expand the money supply that it's something that's private that individuals can do themselves. In other words, you don't have to wait on the government when the government money supply or the bank created money supply is shrinking, and you can't get money any other way. If you create your own community currency system and you can get people to use it, which I think that is one of the problems. But we have some really good models where, such as the Vir in Switzerland, where they have gotten all kinds of businesses to use these community currencies, and that actually expands the money system. So I think that's a good thing. But what I would see as the ultimate solution would be sort of a national community currency system. In other words, a system where people create the credit themselves. But it's the problem to me of a community currency system is that they're all competing with each other, and you can't get everybody to use them. I mean, you're limited to however members you can get in your system. But anyway,
if I might, I've written extensively about exchange alternatives that provide this this credit clearing or local currencies based on local production. We have to find a different way of mediating reciprocal exchange. And I wrote about that. I've written four books on the subject. The last two were Money, Understanding, and Creating Alternatives to Legal Tender. In that book, I laid out a number of different models for local currencies or community currencies, as well as credit clearing exchanges. And the latest book, as you said, is The End of Money and the Future of Civilization, which elaborates the historical evolution of money, the theoretical context, the basic principles that underlie the exchange process. And I have added in that book prescriptions for communities, for businesses, for governments at the local level, the state level, and the national level. So I've thoroughly covered this territory, and as you mentioned, the Vir is a good example of an alternative exchange system, and that's been in existence for 80 years now. It was started during the Great Depression in 1934, when there was a similar scarcity of official money in circulation. So a number of businesses got together to try to figure out how do we continue to do business with one another, even though we don't have very much money? And basically, it was a credit clearing exchange. Basically, what happens in a credit clearing exchange is when you sell something, you get a credit to your account. When you buy something, you get a debit to your account. So it's simply a matter of giving each other credit on a collective basis.
And, is there no interest, though, in the Vir system? Like, I know my daughter, when I was in Switzerland, we went to this wonderful spa that was financed. It had been built with, I think it was $3 million. It was partly Vir and partly the Swiss franc, but it seems to me it was $3 million and like $3 million worth. The franc was about the same as the dollar then, and $500,000 in Vir, so 3 million total, of which 500,000 was in Vir. So let's say you took out, if you're going to pay your workers and materials in Vir, you take out a loan, right, from the bank for the 500,000 and pay them off.
That's not,
or how do you get the Vir?
That may be the way it works in the Vir now, but the Vir has gone through many different changes and modifications over its 80-year history. So I don't want to get into the details of that particular episode that you mentioned, but ideally there would be no interest charged on mutual credit for the clearing process. And here I make a distinction between exchange credit and finance credit. I discussed this in my book, The End of Money. Finance credit is for long-term capital improvement or capital development projects. And that's what you're talking about. The exchange process is in need of short-term credit, just long enough to give traders the time to find what they need in the system, to spend the credits that they've earned by providing what they offer to others in the system. Ideally, this is simply a way of extending trade credit. Now, buyers and sellers in the market often provide trade credit to one another. I'll send you the goods today, and you have 30 days or 60 days to pay me. Mm-hmm. And this is without interest. Both the buyer and the seller benefit because it enables them to have this space in time in which everyone can find satisfaction. So it gets around the barter limitation of having two people that have what each other wants.
So when we bring like the 30 days on a credit card, it's interest-free.
That's another example. So ideally, in order to avoid this exponential growth disaster that we have in the current system, mutual credit clearing exchanges should not impose interest on either positive or negative balances. That's the ideal, and that's the way.
What if you thought you were going to get paid at the end of 60 days and you didn't? Which, can you carry the debt, and can you carry it for free, or do you
pay payments? Now you're talking about settling accounts. In a credit clearing exchange, there's no reason to ever settle accounts because settlement requires payment in some other currency. So we're trying to do away with our dependence on conventional political currencies. So we don't need to settle. All we need to do is to keep the accounts balanced. Each account has to sell as much as they buy and buy as much as they sell. So the way we adjust that is by allocating the overdraft privilege in the mutual credit clearing exchange. Each account is allocated a certain amount of credit. That is, they can go into the negative by a certain amount that's based on their sales history. And as your sales history develops, your credit line can be adjusted either upward or downward to make sure that you're always buying as much as you sell and selling as much as you buy. We only allow a relatively small amount of imbalance on each account, say 2 or 3 months sales into the system. This is a rule of thumb that's been established over time based on actual experience.
I can think of a lot more questions I would ask you about that, but I want to get to something that was in the news that you had written an email on, and I thought it was really interesting, that the fact that Russian President Putin was dropping in on the Chinese president recently, apparently to seal the deal between the Russian energy giant Gazprom and the giant state-controlled China National Petroleum Corporation to supply the Chinese with natural gas for 30 years, starting in 2018. So this has raised alarm bells because they are maybe doing the deal in their own currencies. And then we have all these other alliances between the BRIC countries, including a development bank that will compete with the IMF and the World Bank. So the rumor is, or the fear is, or many experts are saying that this is the end of dollar hegemony and that everything will collapse. But I know you have... I mean, there's some people that say this is a good thing. We need the balance of the Russians and the Chinese because we, the people, are not the hegemons. It's the big corporations or the big bankers, and they're running riot over us just like they're running riot over everybody else. So I just wonder what your view on that is and what your global solution would be, or your solution to global, you know, currency competition, the currency wars.
Yeah, good question. My worldview has been shaped by a lot of the research that I've done over the years. And what you have to understand is that the context that we're dealing with in the world today is not one of nation against nation. The United States, as the world's only superpower, is actually the military arm of a global elite, which is being used to force every nation and every economic entity into what has been called the New World Order. Now, George Herbert Walker Bush, the first Bush president, spoke a lot about the New World Order. And when people began to ask questions about what this New World Order was going to look like, he sort of pulled back on that and stopped talking about it. But if you do a study of history, especially monetary history, you come to realize that what they have in mind is a new world order that's based on control of the global money and banking system. And one of the sources that I consulted is Carol Quigley, and I know you've quoted Carol Quigley as well. He was Bill Clinton's mentor at Georgetown University, and Bill Clinton had very high praise for Carol Quigley. He was a historian, and he developed a theory of history and wrote a book called The Evolution of Civilizations, which was a scientific approach to history, where he tried to outline the principles by which civilizations rise and fall. Well, Quigley said that the powers of financial capitalism had a far-reaching plan to dominate all the governments through their control of the money and banking system. I don't have that quote in front of me at the moment, but basically that's what's been going on for the last 300 years, a gradual process of increasing control over everything in the world through the control of money and banking. If you think of money as being sort of like water flowing in a river, that river starts somewhere at a wellspring, and you can think of money as flowing through the economy like a river. And the wellspring of money is the commercial banks that basically create it on the basis of your signature on a loan, for example, or a government bond, which is a loan to the government. So whoever controls the wellspring controls the river, and whoever controls the creation of money controls the economy and the governments as well. So what we have is an attempt in recent years especially to pull every country into this new world order, which is controlled by the global banking elite. And so the Russians and the Chinese and the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and others, are showing signs of not wanting to necessarily go that direction. So they are forming their own exchange systems. They are forming their own financing systems, and this is sort of putting a roadblock in the way of the New World Order. So if you look at world developments in light of this development, this way of interpreting world affairs, then you can see what's really going on. You know, the overthrow of the governments in North Africa, Libya, Iraq, the attempt to overthrow the government in Syria, this is all part of the New World Order plan. And likewise, the United States and its Western allies have been trying to ring-fence Russia and China by going into the former Soviet Union countries, getting them into NATO, getting them in debt to the IMF. This is all part of the plan to take control through their global financial and monetary system.
Yeah. Well, I've written about that the rogue nations, the nations that we pegged as rogue nations, are basically Islamic nations that don't believe in usury or interest-bearing debt or usurious interest-bearing debt, and that they have their own central banks that issue national credit. And so it's a totally different system than the international banking system, the one that Carol Quigley wrote about. And so the real reason that they're rogue nations and that we've gone after them is that is an attempt to snuff out this idea that governments can issue their own money and that that you could have an interest-free system of some sort.
Exactly.
But we have these, now we have Russia and China, which in the BRICS in general, I mean, there's no way that you can label them rogue nations and go after them. They're just too big. So I see that all as a good thing, as it, that we do have a counterbalance that can protect us, the little people, against our own parasitic system, which is drowning out the homeowners and the students and everybody that they're managing to trap into debt. And I've heard, like Catherine Austin Fitz says, no way is the dollar going to go down just because of, I mean, that we've got like $40 trillion in black ops secrets.
Well, the dollar will continue to exist. The question is, what is it going to buy? The United States is the biggest debtor nation in the world, and the U.S. government deficits keep mounting up. And the only way that those deficits can be financed is by the central bank monetizing that debt, which puts new reserves into the banking system, which enables the commercial banks to buy more of that debt. So we're putting more and more money into circulation in the economy without a concomitant increase in goods and services going into the economy. So basically, it's printing counterfeit money. And the biggest counterfeiter is the central bank and the government. So what we have to recognize is that the purchasing power of the dollar is going to continue to decline, and probably at an accelerating rate. So if we're smart, we'll try to reduce our dependence on dollars and banks. And if we have any savings at all, get them out of the banks. You know, in Europe, they've already taken steps to say that if necessary, people's savings accounts will be appropriated in order to save the banking system. And that's probably going to happen in the United States as well. The trial balloon for that was Cyprus last year, okay, when they confiscated a portion of savers' bank deposits. So the system is going to be saved. They will take every measure necessary to keep this system going. And, of course, you and I are going to pay for it. So we have to reduce our dependence on that system and get out of dollar-denominated security. Now, going back to the international finance part of it, those countries could create a mutual credit clearing system amongst themselves in order to avoid having to use dollars as the reserve currency. That's essentially using their own currencies, but they would have to keep their trade in balance in order to avoid getting into the same kinds of problems that we have now. And they would have to do it on an interest-free basis. Down at the grassroots level, we can avoid dollar dependence in our communities by building up community credit clearing exchange systems and then networking those together so that we can obtain what we need from others that are outside our local region.
I would suggest public banking works as well, because then the profits are going back to the people or going back to the government, reducing taxes, et cetera. Of course, they've written a lot on that.
Public banking is good for the finance function, where you need long-term credit
right,
in order to start businesses or to expand businesses or to do infrastructure projects in the local area.
Right.
They could also eventually operate the mutual credit clearing on a non-interest basis.
I just have one. We don't have too much time left, but this whole phenomenon of Thomas Piketty's book, Capitalism in the 21st Century, being a number, I mean, it's like number one bestseller. It's an economics text, which is mind-blowing that it would shoot up there like that. I know that Tom Krugman's recommendation did a lot to promote it. But what do you think of this phenomenon?
Piketty's book was basically a rigorous academic approach to showing that, yes, there is tremendous disparities in income and wealth around the world. And so that's why it's getting so much attention. You know, many of us have been saying this for a long time, but Piketty has the academic credentials, and he has made a solid argument in support of the contention that there is tremendous and increasing wealth and income disparity. So that's why it's getting so much attention. It's basically a credible source telling us what we already knew.
Yeah.
I think that's a good thing.
And he doesn't really say why all that is happening, so it sort of opens up the field for lots more writing. I mean, we can
We have the explanations of why that's happening.
Well, one other thing I was going to mention was the Bangla Pesa in Kenya. I wrote about that, and you wrote about that.
Well, the Bangla Pesa is a project that's been set up by Will Ruddock, an American development worker in Kenya. And essentially, it's providing credit clearing for people who are micro-entrepreneurs in a slum area around Mombasa. And now, with the government's help, he's been asked to replicate that system in other parts of Kenya. His basic model is to work with micro-entrepreneurs in small slum area communities where there isn't a lot of official currency in circulation. So basically, the people who are producing value in those communities are creating their own exchange media based on their own local production. And this is a very promising project, which I encourage everyone to support. He recently concluded an Indiegogo crowdfunding campaign. I don't think he got nearly as much money as he was looking for, but he certainly deserves all the support that we can give him.
Right. Yeah, what I particularly liked about that was that it was such a, well, it was a, like you say, it was a community where they didn't have money at all or didn't have much of the national currency. And by putting this currency into the system, like giving everybody a small amount, it was like $5 worth or something, they now had money to spend on each other's products. And it immediately increased GDP by 20%. So it just shows that if you put the money in there first, I mean, everybody thinks it's going to be inflationary if the government adds money to the system. But if they put the money into the pockets of the people that are going to buy things rather than into the pockets of the banks, which are just going to speculate with it, then it will stimulate production and you'll have supply and demand being balanced. So prices won't shoot up, but rather.
It all depends on how the money is issued. And it's basically a monetization of the value that those people are themselves creating. You just can't willy-nilly put money into circulation and expect it to work correctly. You know, this is a large part of what I've written about in my books, as well as in the article that I had published last year in the Internet Journal of Complementary Currency Research. You have to properly allocate credit within the group of producers in order to make it work correctly.
Well, it's been great talking to you. Do you want to give your website and any other data?
Yes, I would direct listeners to my main website at beyondmoney.net, beyondmoney.net. And my latest book is called The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. Those will get people started. There are other links from that website and in my book.
Okay, thanks very much.
Well, thank you, Ellen.
That was Thomas Greco, writer and lecturer, and the author of numerous books, including The End of Money and the Future of Civilization.
On today's Public Banking Report, we'll be talking about the extraordinary fact that most cities are far from broke, that there are literally trillions of dollars owned by municipalities around the country that could be used to help cities finance dramatic economic recoveries, if only they had a public bank to leverage their credit. Our guest today is Scott Baker, the popular columnist and blogger, and an expert on evaluating city documents called Comprehensive Annual Financial Reports, which show people where this money is. Scott has been consulting with public banking teams around the country to help them get a handle on how much money their towns, cities, and counties actually have stashed away.
Scott, welcome to the Public Banking Report. It's nice to have you. You know, you're a bit of an icon in this growing field simply because you've taken on a detailed task of revealing a little-known truth that many of our so-called broke cities have lots of money. You know where it is and how to get it and how to maybe use it for a public bank. So tell us what the secret is and tell us what it is.
All right. Well, basically what people hear about when they think a city is broke is the budget. Now, the budget is not all the city's assets. That's basically a report of X accounts from Y resources, mostly taxation resources. So in other words, whatever is taxed is used to pay for a certain number of items every year, year in, year out, so it doesn't go beyond the year. And so that's the budget. Kind of like your personal wallet. If you take your wallet out, you have a certain amount of money, and then it gets replenished, and then it goes out, and you spend on a certain finite number of things. But the CAFR is much bigger. The CAFR is literally the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, and it includes everything that the city owns, all the assets, capital, fixed capital, and non-fixed, going back to the beginning of the city's incorporation. Basically, all cities are incorporated now.
So these funds or these assets have been around sometimes for 100 years, more than 100 years?
Yes, certainly. Yeah. Obviously, they're more lately because of inflation, but they've had a long time to be invested, and they've been invested in a number of things which we'll talk about. But they're basically hidden from most of the citizens of the city or the state, but they're hidden in plain sight. Because in the last 10 years or so, basically all of them have been put online. So if you live in, let's say, New York State, you can go and look up New York State CAFR, C-A-F-R, and you'll find the page which has the last 10 years, basically, of all of the CAFR reports. And you can look at each one. And when you learn to read them, it's not too bad because they're all pretty standard. They all follow GAAP accounting, with a few exceptions for small entities. I did a financial report for Princeton and another one for Mercer County in New Jersey, and they have a trial balance format, which is a kind of non-standard, non-GAAP format, which makes it hard to decipher.
Now, by GAAP, Scott, you're referring to the general accounting principles?
Yeah, by the government accounting standard.
Oh, government accounting standard, okay.
Yeah, so it's generally accepted accounting principles, but it's put out by the GASB. So once you learn to read one, you pretty much learn to read them all. Now, it can be daunting at first because they can be a couple of hundred pages, but you learn to zero in on things like net assets, which is usually listed in the table of contents, and then you can just go to that particular summary page, and then you can find out what the assets of the entity are. You don't really have to worry about the revenues and the liabilities too much because money comes in, it goes out. But what you're really interested in, as far as our purposes for funding a public bank, are which assets are consistently there year after year.
So the revenues and the liabilities are basically the budget items, right? Those are the ones that are, by at the end of a year, the city or the municipal entity has to have a balanced budget by law. Isn't that generally the case?
Yes, the budget is actually for the year, so balance things coming in and going out for that year. Now, there are liabilities, future liabilities, which, frankly, some politicians have sloppily included when they say that the city or state is broke when they make these statements, because they may go out 10 years. They may even go out 20 or 30 years. So if you've got liabilities that go decades out and you're looking at current revenues, obviously you're going to be broke all the time.
And an example of that would be like pension funds, right?
And Detroit did this a little bit. As a matter of fact, I spoke to a senior vice president of Moody's about this and for press relations, and he confided to me that they've basically changed the way that they do their analysis so that all the entities will be the same, all cities and states will be treated the same, which in this case meant that they would look further out for most of those cities and states than they used to do, because some used to be 5 years out, some used to be 10, and the most would be like 20 or something. So basically they're taking the longest view on everything now.
And the impact of that is to diminish the overall sense of wealth of the city somehow?
It's like if you have to pay your mortgage, your 30-year mortgage, all at once. Obviously nobody could do that and they would all be broke. Now they do make some provision for future revenues, but it's not done well, because what happens is they base it on current receipts, and so they say, well, this is what employees, for example, are making now, or the city is getting on their, let's say, their bond returns now, and maybe they'll adjust it a little bit for inflation, but they don't do it very well, and it tends to come out too low. As a matter of fact, it was a Reuters article that said bond projections going forward from this point are going to be too low because we're at historically low interest rates. So any city that is projecting bond returns based on today's rates is going to be under-projecting significantly because we've got historically low inflation and even lower interest rates because of what the Fed is doing with QE to keep rates artificially low. So if you're projecting returns and you say, well, you've got returns of 0.25% or even 1% now, and you project that out 20 years, well, that's not realistic because historically inflation has averaged around 3%, so probably have some higher inflation, therefore bond rates tend to go more or less with inflation, so you'll have higher bond returns as well. So your fund will do better and offset inflation, and they don't really project that properly.
So let me just remind our listeners that what we're talking about here are the consolidated annual financial reports where the real money for the city is stashed that most people don't know about.
Yeah, I guess I should have led with the – I buried the lead a little bit. For example, in New York State, there's $150 billion in the pension fund. In New York City, there's about that much as well. Actually, both numbers are a little bit higher. That's of June, as of June 2013. But you can go online and you can see all of these things. So I've done that, and I know New York State pretty well. And so you're already looking at $300 billion or more. And basically, you know, pension funds pay out about 6%. Our pension fund for the state has paid out from 4.5, I think, to 8.9% over a 10-year span. Depending on the returns, really, not so much how much the pensioners take, because their take is fairly consistent, even if there are big layoffs, you know, you can't, it's kind of baked in. You can't change that very much. So basically, they take the same amount out every year. But what does vary tremendously is the returns on these funds, because they're all invested in equity or in bonds or in, you know, various asset markets. For example, New York State had $154 billion in 2008, and then a year later it only had $110 billion in their pension fund because they lost so much money on the markets. That was when they passed.
So the importance of this, in addition to providing the aha moment, we really do have money, we're not broke, is that when we talk about public banking and creating a public bank for a municipality or city or state or whatever, the concern is, well, how are we going to capitalize it? Where do we get cash that has to go into to capitalize the public bank? Where are we going to get that? And the answer that seems most appropriate and most available in these situations are these accounts that are represented in the CAFRs.
Right.
Is that right? That's the strategy and the importance here, right?
Yeah, I mean, these are basically liquid accounts. Certainly pension funds are all liquid. There's no fixed capital in those. But then there's agency and enterprise accounts, which get a little more complicated because they may have fixed capital like roads and bridges and things like that. But you could separate those out. And there's still billions and billions of dollars. And I should say there's 200,000 or so of these CAFRs nationwide. If you look at all the little towns and cities and agencies and pension funds and all these entities that have to have them, states and federal government too. So, you know, you're looking at tens of trillions of dollars cumulatively. And so when people say, you know, government is broke, well, it's not. What's happened is this money has been committed. It's put into the stock and bond markets primarily. Often, well, not often, but enough to be significant, it's not even in this country. For example, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, which I looked at, the CAFR, a little over $900 million, actually. In other words, almost $1 billion in investments in equity and bonds outside of the country in foreign currencies. So there were over 20 foreign currencies, everything from the pound to the euro to the krona anyway. I guess the lira doesn't exist.
Which, of course, should be a bit of an embarrassment for a public administrator insofar as that it's not invested locally. Why would we want to be investing in futures in Brunei or in foreign currencies when the money could be used locally? Of course, that's the public banking message, I suppose. We really need to keep our money at home.
I mean, I give you an example. I'm looking at it right now. The Philadelphia Pension Fund has investments in the Thai baht, B-A-H-T.
Uh-huh.
So we know what happened in Thailand. They just had a kind of revolution. So what kind of safety do you have for your investment out there? Turkey is another place they have investments in. Malaysia, you know, all of these countries have had problems. So I understand the need for diversification, but, you know, this is a bit of a myth that the more you diversify, the safer your investments are. That's only true up to a point. After that, you're really just paying a lot of fees and a lot of money managers making millions of dollars.
Well, let's take a look at that for a minute, Scott. Here we've discovered the treasure chest. And now the guardians of the treasure chest are the people who are running, who are fund managers, and of course the comptroller's office and the treasurer's office all have reasons, and good ones no doubt, agencies and authorities have static investment strategies and products, but there is a lot of money in the managing of that. In addition to the interest that we're paying to banks, we're paying for money management on the municipal level. So do you foresee a lot of trouble in getting some of these funds reallocated or invested into, let's say, a public bank?
Absolutely. I mean, if anybody out there has ever had a fund manager manage their stock portfolio or something, and you know, they'll suggest 20 different funds, and or 40 if you have enough money. And first of all, they don't like to take no for an answer. And second, if you do invest in that kind of arrangement, it's very difficult to pull your money out later, as anybody would tell you. So it's even more so, of course, when you talk about big cities with $100 billion or $200 billion dollars to invest. So these are prizes, you know, not only for the citizens, but for the fund industry, for all of these, you know, Fidelity and Vanguard and certainly hedge funds. There are some hedge funds involved. I've looked at the listing of some of these managers, these companies that manage these funds, and it goes on for page after page. So a very tiny type. It can be a 10-point type, two columns for 8-10 pages.
Are you able to identify who the fund managers are in the CAFRs?
You know, you've got the usual, the Goldman Sachs and the Morgan Stanleys and those bigger ones, but there are a lot of small, you know, small firms that manage a good amount of money. When you've got a large entity, it would really take the rest of our time and time's end.
Well, I think it's important for us to point out to those of our listeners who are fund managers and of these funds that the public banking strategy isn't to put these people out of business. We're really just talking about trying to get a handle on some of the available wealth that's resident in the city to invest in ourselves. So, for example, the Philadelphia strategy I'm familiar with is that we're, you know, our proposal is to let's take 10% of the money that's in the market and let's use that cash to capitalize a bank. That seems to be quite a reasonable starting point, or at least a you know, compromise, a middle ground.
Yeah, and I think it would be very hard to make the opposing case that an investment in a well-managed public bank, assuming it's well-chartered and set up along conservative guidelines, like, for example, the Bank of North Dakota, would not be a safer investment than many of the investments that 10% would come out of.
Can you tell in the CAFRs what kind of returns are being realized? Where is that data available in all those public documents?
That's generally in the introduction section, and the returns are typically 6%, 7%, occasionally 8%, but not on average. That would be a very good year. Now, remember, they don't put everything in stock, so of course they're looking for a little bit of safety. They may put it in a low-yield bond. They may have some in treasuries and so forth. So that would lower the return overall. But, you know, the equity portion is certainly arguably, or the bond portion, with some of which have C ratings, are arguably more risky than a public bank would be. So if you were to take 10% out for a public bank, you could take it out of that port and probably not even diminish the returns. You would probably enhance the returns. And it would be countercyclical because, you know, the Bank of North Dakota gives us an example of countercyclicality where the bank continues to profit even when the overall economy remains weak because they find things to invest in within the state, or they can even, you know, delay collection on certain loans if they choose to.
Yeah, that's a really important point because when you talk about diversifying your portfolio for safety and or for, you know, maybe broader range of returns, the tendency to be countercyclical to what's going on in the economy is in itself a firewall and a security blanket to some extent. And the diversity isn't necessarily sacrificed either, because if you're investing locally, there are multiple types of investment that would be occurring through, including multiple community banks who would be administering some of these funds.
Right. And it should be pointed out, you know, that we're talking about CAFRs, but speaking of community banks, the FDIC did a good study of community banks, and they found basically that the states that have a high ratio of community banks per capita have low ratio of foreclosures. It's not exactly one-to-one, but it's pretty close. And, of course, the best state in the country is North Dakota, which has the highest ratio of community banks plus public state bank. So that combination makes their foreclosure rate drastically lower than any other state.
So what kind of agencies inside of the local government would these funds be distributed across? Who's holding this money and why?
Well, you have all kinds of enterprise agencies. The airport is an agency, the water department's an agency, sewer schools are agency, gas works. Looking at Philadelphia Community College of Philadelphia Community Behavioral Health, Delaware River Waterfront Corporation. These are all city agencies, basically, and they all have basically their own pools of money, even though it's reported in the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report as, one collection of all the pools. But they've managed their own money. They can invest within certain limits, more or less as they want. So, these would be prime targets. If you're setting up a public bank, you could go to the head of those agencies and try to garner support. And I guess if you get enough of them, then maybe the treasurer or the comptroller would start to listen and see this as a good investment.
So somebody who's working on building a public bank in their area would, after looking at the CAFRAs, identify some of the authorities and agencies that have a stash of cash and say, look, here's another opportunity, and get some collaborative support from those agency heads. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah. And the agency heads are much less likely to be influenced, let's say, by Wall Street promises or promises of jobs after leaving office, because they're basically in a different business, even though they may invest the money. So, if you get away from the treasurer's office or the comptroller's office a little bit, you'll probably get away from the worst of the Wall Street investment hooks.
The influence. Well, Scott, this is a very big conversation, and before we leave, I really would like you to share how people can get in touch with your really excellent work. You've done a number of videos describing this whole CAFR process. I know you've got PowerPoints as well. Where would people go online to find out more about this particular part of the public banking process?
Well, you can go to my blog, because I've collected them all in the same place. So if you go to newthinking.blogspot.com, you'll find both my video presentations and the slideshows that back them up, including to Occupy Wall Street, to the Public Banking Institute, and a variety of audiences.
I'm going to repeat that name again. It's newthinking.blogspot.com to see Scott's work and a collection of really great data-based presentations that have been very instrumental around the country. Scott's very busy working in collaboration with Public Banking Institute in the new markets that are just growing, that are pursuing the public banking agenda, or at least investigating it. Scott, I'm afraid we're going to have to call that quits for today, but I know Ellen wants to talk to you more extensively on an upcoming It's Our Money show. So thank you so much for joining us today, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you.
That was Scott Baker, New York State Coordinator for the Public Banking Institute. Well, that will do it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Remember that you can find Ellen's latest articles and insights on her blog at ellenbrown.com, and you can join her mailing list to get fresh notifications of her latest work. For more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. And for podcasts of our shows, visit prn.fm and go to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Thanks to our guests today, Tom Greco and Scott Baker, and to you for listening. On behalf of Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. All best to you. Money.